It's a great pleasure to welcome to this conversation Isaac Schwartz, the portfolio manager of Robati Global Fund, which Isaac started in 2007. I'm sure all of you will be familiar with Isaac. He has shared his wisdom, insights, and ideas with the MY Global community in the past, and I've had the pleasure of hosting Isaac personally at events like Idea Week, where I also truly appreciated his contributions. Isaac, I'm grateful that we have this opportunity to speak at a turbulent time in the markets, some would say an unprecedented time, and I'd love to get your perspective on this moment.
Sure. Yeah, every unprecedented time is a new, interesting, new unprecedented time. I see a crisis as being a great amplifier, actually, that exposes the things that we already knew about our economy, the inefficiencies as well as the efficiencies. So one area that we've been investing in for years at Robati and Company is in e-commerce generally in a number of different verticals. And in the last few years, an area that's been of enormous interest to us is food e-commerce, and specifically grocery e-commerce. So this crisis highlights the incredible importance of grocery e-commerce, and I think is really a catalyst to take something that makes so much sense for society and accelerate the process of its implementation. Groceries are so top of mind for everybody now. If you're sitting in New York, you know, good luck getting a Fresh Direct or an Amazon Prime Now or an Amazon Fresh slot. If you're watching this in London, good luck getting an Ocado slot. I hear from people that you need to log in at 2-3 a.m. to get online on the virtual line. So groceries are very top of mind. Last time I participated with MOI, which I always greatly enjoy, was at an in-person MOI conference about 2 months ago, which of course 2 months now feels like it, you know, could have been 2 years ago. But the subject of my talk then was the grocery industry's dirty little secret. And at that time I talked about wastage as being a catalyst to move to online, to centralized warehousing for groceries and to online sales and to fulfillment from centralized warehouses because of the inventory management aspect and because of the ability to control waste that way. But today what we're seeing, so my comments then, which we could get back into in a minute if you'd like, John, or if people listening are interested, but my comments then were very much focused on the financial aspects of more rapid inventory, of more rapid asset turn, and the improved working capital metrics of having much, much higher inventory turn that is facilitated through centralized warehousing. Today we're seeing that online grocery also has huge marketing advantages, and people are going to learn. I've been saying for years that it was going to take some time to get into our minds, into my mind, into all of our minds, that it makes so much sense to order your groceries online that eventually people would realize that if I want the privilege of picking out the blueberries, picking out the lamb chops, and inspecting them in the store, I'm going to eventually realize that every single time you will pay more money for a less fresh product because you want to do that, because there are literally days tacked onto the inventory cycle. Now people are confronted with the idea that if they can get things delivered to them without needing to go outside in these big cities like New York, where who knows what our infection rate is. I think our official registered infections are 30,000 or something now. But I mean, I personally know more than a dozen people who, we're sure have it. Thank God are doing okay. But anyway, who don't have tests. So the point is, it's everywhere. I saw reports this morning that the Harvard president and some member of the royal family, it's everywhere. So the idea of getting things home delivered is extremely attractive in that environment. And it's going to start to change the collective, psyche about this. So, other forms of e-commerce have shifted online more quickly because the logistics surrounding them weren't quite as specialized as the logistics around grocery logistics, where a shopping cart can have close to 100 items. The items can have very different sizes, temperature storage requirements, and where the average price of the items is low, and therefore where the gross margin where the profit off of each item in just in absolute dollars is a small amount. And so, the necessity of handling that very efficiently, as opposed to say, some luxury fashion items where a 500 or 1,000 euro item might have hundreds of euros of gross margin to play around with. So I see this crisis as introducing a lot of interesting opportunities, because although we need to be careful with companies that have financial leverage and companies that have operating leverage where they won't be able to adjust their businesses in an efficient manner, we also see companies that have that have reverse effects that make all the sense and that are seeing major accolades happening today. I would point out, John, that there's been a temporary boost to many supermarket stocks. Some of these, like Kroger and Walmart, I think are extremely well positioned generally from an e-commerce point of view. And potentially some of the investors getting excited about those companies are excited about the e-commerce aspects. But some grocers, I get the sense, are jumping and are experiencing a little bit of stock market excitement in a brutal stock market, because they're getting a bump in their sales, and that I would say is a temporary effect. People are hoarding some long shelf life items. People are hoarding some long shelf life items, and it's facilitating a temporary effect that will not that will not last. So our idea, the way that we're facing this investing through a crisis is looking for some great opportunities, some of which are trends that we were already big believers in and already investors in, but we actually think are going to potentially you move up the time frame significantly, even by years, just a couple of years, but you move up the time frame for widespread adoption and it can have very exciting effects because for e-commerce where real estate costs obviously, you know, get yanked away. There are warehouses, but those can be strategically located in expensive industrial warehousing, in expensive industrial estates because it's near on-ramps to major highways, but not high street real estate. But you're adding in significant delivery costs, but delivery costs are a function of density. And if you can have a rapid growth in e-commerce drops, you can do incredible things to cost structures by increasing densities. So I could go on right now, although if...
I'll jump in maybe with a question.
Yeah, let's jump in with some discussion.
A question that kind of came up as you were speaking is how do companies like Ocado, let's say, judge what part of this increase is going to be sustainable and what's just a temporary spike? Definitely adoption is accelerating and they will need more capacity quickly. Mm-hmm. But how does a business like that go about adding capacity prudently so that they don't overdo it either?
That's a fantastic question because exactly maybe there's some temporary effect where people want to order groceries online because they're scared to go out because they don't want to be in a supermarket and exposed to other people with the virus. But I believe that groceries delivered online makes so much sense that it's going to be the end result of the world anyway. And now there's sort of like a marketing trigger for people to consider it in a new way that they hadn't considered. The stage one value proposition of online groceries is a very basic sort of a value proposition, which is just customer convenience. The I call it stage one value proposition, but the basic value proposition is that it's a nice luxury to get that time back in your schedule and to not have to, you know, do that extra little commute to the grocer and walk around the aisles and pick. But the stage two value proposition of the online grocer is the real value proposition is the efficiency that it adds to the food supply chain and the improvement to the profitability at all levels of the food supply chain, the producers and the distributors by speeding up the supply chain so much and by allowing everybody to hold so much less working capital and get such a higher inventory turn on capital. So you know, Ocado adding capacity, since I know there's a lot, we have a lot of friends in the UK and the MOI community. Ocado is a 20-year-old grocer in the UK that in about 2 months will be operating in Paris and Toronto with leaders in those markets, Group Casino and Sobeys supermarkets in Toronto. And soon after we'll be operating in many other parts of the world, here in the US and in Japan, Australia, Sweden. Ocado indeed has had a run for their products where they've had to limit orders, but this trend was happening already. Ocado is actually a great one to ask about, John, because they have a 20-year history doing online only groceries, and they have a 10-year history as a public company. So there's a lot of data out about them. And they've been and they've been growing, you know, far, far faster than you know, GDP population, which is, you know, which is what basically governs grocery growth. People don't, you know, don't consume more calories. It just sort of grows with population. But they've been taking share without spending money advertising, just because there's been a gradual shift in the UK, which is really at the forefront, far, far ahead of, you know, of regions of the US that mirror the UK, such as the Northeastern Corridor, which has similar population density. The UK has been at the forefront. We have a private grocer in New York that it's tough to get data on, but a really excellent grocer, Fresh Direct, which was in Queens for the last 20 years, and then recently in the last year moved up to the South Bronx. And from this one facility in the South Bronx, Fresh Direct is supplying Boston down to DC from one single grocery store, which is amazing. If there are any, you know, Fresh Direct, which is private, shareholders or board members in the MOI community, I hope they'll get in touch with me, because I'm a very happy customer of Fresh Direct, and have some ideas for the company. But this effect is not that online grocers just make sense in a time of a pandemic. Online grocery makes sense for the customers, for the food industry, and it's where the world is headed to. And then a pandemic suddenly makes people who maybe were thinking, oh, well, you know, I don't want to create a new account with a new login. You know, who has weariness of having too many accounts and passwords in this world, or who thinks to themselves, oh, you know, I can just go to the grocer, or, you know, send somebody to go to the grocer. I don't need to try something new. Suddenly people are trying something new. And again, density kicks in, because when there's no density, potentially the costs need to be much higher. But when there's density of the take up of the service, you know, suddenly it's integrated into how the providers are pricing the product. And it means that there's no premium pricing for something, or very little premium pricing, because it fits into an overall cost structure. And we've already started to see, this was one of the things that that we talked about at the last live MOI conference, which was some of the clever second tier grocers in New York. I used as an example the D'Agostino's Gristiti's group, which is run by some very brilliant value investors, Katsimatidis family in New York. You've actually seen them start to slowly exit the business, because what happened to them over the last, you know, half a dozen decades was that they had these local monopolies, because, you know, you know, 50 years ago, if you had a grocery store, your customer base was within a few blocks. And, you know, now they're converting those into real estate. And you know, quietly, you're starting to see a lot of deals like this of companies, of very substantial companies that don't want to make these investments in e-commerce capacity. And so they just exit. It was very interesting to see. I guess it was about a year ago, but a hundred year old business, a family business in Long Island. If some MOI members have decamped out to the East End, King Cullen Supermarkets, that they exited the business through a combination with the number three player in the U.S., which is the Dutch Ahold that operates the Stop and Shop brand, and Giant, some other brands here, they merged into them because Ahold has invested heavily in their online capacity through their Peapod brand, and now they're selectively rolling out to some of the Peapod online brand and to some bricks, some of their in-house bricks and mortar brands. And so, you know, the Cullen family, I assume, didn't make the decision lightly to exit a 100-year-old family business with dozens of stores all throughout Long Island, Nassau and Suffolk County, kind of a beloved family-owned brand. But they saw the writing on the wall of this shift, and you need scale to invest heavily to accommodate the shift. So I don't think that there's any effect of any capacity that's being built now. That's, first of all, it's not very easy to bring on capacity, which we see because all the time slots are booked. It isn't as if Amazon Prime Fresh in the New York area can just wave a magic wand. Walmart, which is the largest grocer in the U.S., Walmart can't wave a magic wand. They don't do grocery delivery in Manhattan, for example. They do grocery delivery in New Jersey, and good luck getting a slot. They can't wave magic wand and bring on capacity. So I think that, you know, new capacity that's coming on will have some, you know, marketing help in getting its story out. Yes, will be long-term capacity that will eventually free up more and more high street real estate to be repurposed for things other than selling groceries.
Is this a hopeless battle for all traditional grocers, or do you see some of them able to adapt and compete in the online space?
I think that grocers are like other retailers in that, you know, we hear this term now, experiential retail, and it's so, so true that you need to make the process of going into the store fun. For viewers who are in the New York area, if you haven't been to the Whole Foods store at Bryant Park, I would say that's a must visit. The same way that the Nike stores uptown on Midtown Fifth Avenue and on Lower Broadway, the Samsung store in the Meatpacking District. These are stores that must be seen by anyone investing in commercial real estate in any capacity, anyone investing in any sort of retail, because these stores tell the future of where retail is headed. So that Whole Foods at Bryant Park, you go up to the second floor, and it's like a delightful food market. It almost feels like what's the name of, there's a famous food market at Las Ramblas in Barcelona. I can't remember the name right now. Anyway, all throughout Europe and in particularly in Southern Europe and Portugal, Italy, you have a lot of examples of this where it's like a, you know, like a big floor of a department store, and there's like little shops, and it's kind of fun to walk through, and you can go to, you know, to a meat restaurant, or you go to a seafood restaurant. So Whole Foods at Bryant Park has recreated that sort of, you know, European feel that, you know, that I don't remember us ever having in New York for sure. And what's interesting about it is you go in and it really, really looks like it's different stores the shops, there's a oyster bar that has its own name and that has a very independent decoration, but actually they're all, as far as I know, I believe that all of them are not on concession. They're all actually owner operated. There's a sushi shop that for some reason, may be a concession, but the main store, there's an Italian restaurant, there's a full Italian restaurant, and then there's like a pizza bar, and each thing looks different. And so it's really fun to be there. It's just it's lively and it's interesting. So you walk into a new format Whole Foods, you know, you walk into it to an old grocer, and you wonder, you know, what is the selling point of the old grocers? And then, you know, with the higher turnover, it isn't as if the pricing isn't premium in a premium grocery store. The pricing is comparable or lower in the premium grocery store because it does such higher volume.
Isaac, to the extent that you have thoughts on the restaurant business in this context, I'd love to hear them. I mean, is it analogous to grocery? What are the main differences there, and can traditional restaurants survive that transition?
Well, traditional restaurants are experiential, and a lot of friends have been passing around this open table data, obviously, in the last week, showing that, in New York, you're not allowed to sit down in a restaurant. They're only permitted to fulfill delivery or pickup. It's terrible what's happening to the world's restaurants. Cloud kitchens, which is sort of the alternative to traditional restaurants. Cloud kitchens is one step beyond restaurants focusing on delivery. It's known as a cloud kitchen or a dark kitchen. It's a restaurant being reframed to fulfill delivery only. And for doing prepared meals, it does make a lot of sense, because you're changing the real estate pattern, and you're changing the human resources aspect to make sure that every employee is a back of restaurant, just focused on getting the production process down most efficiently and then delivering, as opposed to taking a normal restaurant and then just augmenting its delivery capacity, which from a real estate point of view can sometimes make sense, because a lot of restaurants lease like the back of the restaurant, or even the subterranean part, which has dramatically lower real estate costs than the high street frontage where people are being seated, where the maitre d's podium is. The subterranean part can have its productive capacity augmented and can function a little bit like a cloud kitchen, wherein you don't need to take a restaurant from the East Village in New York and move it, out to some part of Queens that's more industrial, in order to lower the real estate cost. But to get the production process down, it does make some sense. So I think that, restaurants will be forced to adapt and get better and more delightful to spend time in. But certainly, the experience of gathering in a, it's fascinating to see what this crisis has done to stocks of companies, to businesses that are so key to our culture. Live Nation, Eventbrite, restaurant operators, we love to gather, the humans of the world. And we're instructed we're not allowed to gather, but then in the future, how much does the culture change, and how much are people a little reticent to be at that incremental crowded music festival, to be at that lively, bustling restaurant where you're elbow to elbow with your fellow diners. So these are huge questions that we're all thinking about, and that will have fascinating answers to them, because they literally, they face that they address the future of our culture and how we interact. But I don't think that restaurants are going to be replaced by purely by online fulfillment, because when it's safe to go out to restaurants again, I mean, I can't wait to you know, go. I've been, like many members of the MOI community, I've really been enjoying cooking a lot recently, and I think I'm getting much better at it. But it'll be nice to walk around and be in lively atmospheres again. So I don't think the restaurant industry is going to be replaced, but it will certainly be. It already was being forced to adapt. The proliferation of delivery service providers, the enormous amount of money that Uber and the private DoorDash have invested to push the industry forward in a way that Grubhub had not. Grubhub had sort of grown for 20. Grubhub, which is Grubhub Seamless Group, had grown for 20 years on the back of the shift in ordering to from phone ordering to online ordering, and now Uber and DoorDash and some smaller companies, Postmates, have pushed people to start thinking about ordering from restaurants they would not have ordered from before. And so that's a trend, but it's not going to get rid of restaurants.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I'm wondering if there are any other areas of life, of business, where you're seeing trends be accelerated by what's happening currently that are of interest to you?
Well, there's some very interesting. A lot of things are halted temporarily, of course, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the transportation sector. Which of course is somewhat linked to delivery of goods and you know what this will mean for mass rapid transit systems, and what this will mean for taxi providers.
Interesting. Yeah. It's really, I think the question that I keep asking myself is, you know, how much of what people are doing now that might be new to them, they're going to keep when this is all over? And to what extent will they just return to their prior lives? You know, that may kind of drive the extent to which some of these industries get disrupted faster, like grocery. And we don't have the answer, I guess.
Was joking with a friend the other day that if a magic wand caused all this to go back to normal in 2 weeks, the only lasting effect would be that there would be a little bit more hand sanitizer available in the lobbies of public spaces. But I moved to Asia right after SARS in 2005, and you felt the legacy of SARS in that region through till today. The hundreds of times that I've arrived in Hong Kong, whether on a flight or just, you know, walking across the border from mainland China, every single time in the last 15 years, my temperature has been taken. You know, the idea of sterilizing, across Asia, there'll be notices in elevators maybe there'll be like a plastic film and it'll say, you know, sterilize twice an hour or something like that. But if this will really have a lasting effect on people gathering, and if so, for how long, that's a very different question.
And I just wonder, you know, bigger questions, and we don't need any answers right now, but just things like, we've had this trend toward mega cities. Does that trend slow or even reverse as people get a little wary of living in a mega city, especially the ones that are now finding out they can actually do most of their work remotely? So a lot of interesting questions, and I guess we'll have to wait for the answers.
Certainly, John, you make a great point about remote work, and here we are on Zoom video, and you know, we're all learning how efficient video calls can really be, and particularly in those mega metropolises, the idea of having are workers more efficient if they have an extra hour a day of goofing off at home, but, you know, 2 hours a day added of reduced commute time, and it definitely has massive implications for the commercial real estate world. And
I know, Isaac, you're a big traveler, so what does all this mean for your own schedule and your own process?
Well, inspired in part by you, John, 4 years ago, I started to host my own regional summit, and I could see how scary this was getting. So I was going to gather 75 people in Istanbul at the end of April, and in February we postponed it to October. I'm sitting tight. I am appreciative that, you know, everybody in the world has been in this together, and so it does appear really admire the C-suites and IR suites of companies that have done an incredible job at making themselves available for calls this happened to us at a time in human history where suddenly it's free to get on a video call with anybody in an instant. So it would have been a little bit different, you know, even just a decade ago, the amount of, you know, we had some of this stuff, but was there data buffering? Was it really so simple? You know, now keeping in touch with friends and family and doing a company visit, you know, the number of companies that have shifted their annual meetings to online participation annual meetings, but even actually, you know, sitting down with people for meetings has been sort of surprisingly easy. So it is nice sitting with somebody and you know, having a tea at a table with them but you know, doing the same thing virtually. And I guess there'll be even further advancements in this that we're not even imagining now, where there'll be you know, more cameras set up and it can almost be more immersive, the experience of virtually meeting another person.
Great. Well, Isaac, unless you have any closing remarks, I will leave it there. Truly Thank appreciate you, you coming on to share your perspective. Always insightful and enlightening. Thank you very much. And I want to wish you and yours all the very best in this period.
Thanks so much. Same to you and the MRI community.
Goodbye for now.